Okay, so in our, you know, our, the main sugya that we've been dealing with the last few weeks is the prohibition of cooking for a non-Jew on Yom Tov, and the secondary prohibition to not invite them on Yom Tov. But there were a lot of mini sugyas that came up throughout the daf. So here, this page will take us through the Mishnah, through some of the little topics there. So. Let's start with the first one here. So, one topic we've already discussed before is the question of Hoil. All right, so if you look again in Chaf Aleph and Aleph, we sort of run through it because we discussed the main sugya already in Daf Tedvav when we started the Perek, where the Gemara had said, Itmar, this is like, I don't know, it's like, yeah, I don't know, two-thirds down the page. This is the main sugya in Psachim, but here the Gemara mentions it well. That if you cook from Yom Tov for the weekdays, Rav Chista says you get Malkus, and Rabba says you don't. Rav Chista says you get Malkus, because since you're not allowed to cook from Yom Tov to Chol, the heter of Ochol Nevesh only applies to Yom Tov. So lo amrin ha'wil umiklayli orachim chazilei. Hashtanami Chazilei, we don't say that since, in theory, guests could show up, and then the food that you cooked would be used for Yom Tov. So now it's considered that it is also for Yom Tov, and therefore you don't get Malkus.
Isn't that how we pass?
Like Rav Chista? No, we pass like Rabba, right? Which is the next one, which is Rabba Amrino Loka, that you don't get Malkus. Amrino and Hoel. Right, the next one. Amrino and Hoel. Right, we say Hoel.
Yeah.
Right, so that was the... And we saw this at the beginning, right? Because this is the... And this is critical to the way we understand this whole sugya, and we discussed it, I think, 2 weeks ago, that there's a machlokas rishonim. So what, if hoil exists, why is it aser for us to cook, let's say, lechatchila? Why can't we just cook lechatchila for chol, right, with hoil? So some rishonim think that, no, hoil just makes it that there's no malkus, but you still, there's an isser d'araisa to cook for Yom Tov. Other people say, no, hoil really does get rid of the isser d'araisa. It's just that there's an isser d'rabanan to cook from Yom Tov to chol. But at any rate, right, this is the sugya that's in the background, really, of the whole notion of Erev Tavshilin that we discussed for at length at the beginning of the perek. So here I just put a ha'ara. On hoil, right, I'm not going to go back into the whole sugya. We've discussed it in the past. But this I just thought was worth noting. So Tosos in the sugya in Psachim. So this is number one. I just gave you the summary from the Daf al Daf. So he says Tosos even if Tosos in Psachim hikshu iamrin hoil but talto kol melech Shabbos. If you assume hoil now, presumably here according to the Rishonim that hoil actually gets rid of the Isur Daraisa. So he said, why is hoil unique to Yom Tov? We can make up hoils all the time. So, for example, Hoel Mutar L'Chol Sheish Bo Sakana on Shabbos, you could always say, well, it could be that if I cook, or I'm going to put up a cup of tea, and it could be, right, how do you know that, you know, it's negative whatever it is now, negative 2-3 degrees outside, that someone's not going to come in who's suffering from pneumonia, and he just needs a cup of tea. Like, how do you know that someone's not going to come in, right? Hoel, right, if this idea that since, in theory, it could happen, that it's necessary for something, why doesn't that just basically make it that you can never punish someone for violating Shabbos? So Tosfos gives a practical answer. Right, v'tertzu sham, so Tosu's answer is very simple. Hoil only applies when it's a reasonable chance, right? Guests coming in on Yom Tov, so that's something that reasonably could happen, and therefore reasonably you have it in mind. It could be, I mean, yes, I'm cooking now. It's, you know, 2 p.m. I'm cooking for tomorrow. But I know, you know, less than, you know, now, but like at my parents' house, it happens all the time, right? People walk in and out on Yom Tov, right? People are going for a walk, they stop in, they sit down, they have some dessert, they have some tea, whatever, right? People are walking in and out, you know, people that you didn't know were in town or by their kids or by their parents. And you end up, you know, seeing them, you end up walking, and everybody knows on Yom Tov that's possible. So, even if you weren't planning on using the food on Yom Tov, you know that it's possible that something will happen, and you will. The chance that somebody is going to come into your house and is going to dafka need that cup of tea that you put up on Shabbos is so uncommon that it's not within the realm of It is in the realm of possibility, but it's not the realm of plausibility, of probability. Therefore, it doesn't help. V'heir ha'afike yam, d'lefi zeh b'veit cholim, d'shchichi cholim, shuv chozer es kushas atosus l'mkoma. V'mivashol v'es cholim lo ilokes. So the afike yam says, well, there's a problem. If you think that the difference between Shabbos and Yom Tov is simply a practical thing, a numbers thing, so sure, if you are cooking in your house, then it's fully usher and there's no justification of ho'il. But if you're in a hospital, and there's a 30% chance, a 50% chance, that there's going to be somebody later today, or in the next hour, that could need your cup of tea, or whatever it was you were making, right? Or, very simply, the light you turned on, right? You decide you want to go read in the, I don't know why, right? You're on a break, so you go and you read in the operating room, right? In the emergency room. Chances are that someone is going to come in the next few hours, and they're going to have to turn on the light anyways to perform. I don't know if they turn off the lights. I have no idea. But assuming they turn off the light, no, probably not. Probably never turn off the lights. Whatever. Come up with a scenario. He said, the point is, if it's practical, then I can construe a situation where it's also practical that there'll be a sick person who needs what you're doing. So ha'achronim tertu teres tu'achar. For that reason, the achronim say no. And this is, right, cuts to the heart of ho'il. He said, no, it's different. Din ho'il, matzinu rak b'mechaleches yom tov, ho'il meleches ochel nefesh should be. That was a bad typo. Okay, fine. That is ochel nefesh hutra b'yom tov. V'yish rak gorim stadi, shemesalik aheter, hainu shafel etzarachol. He said, there's a difference. And we discussed this a little bit earlier. How do we look at the heter of ochel nefesh? Is it that really malacha is asur on Yom Tov, but if you're doing it for food, so then it's mutter? Or do you say no? On Yom Tov, any malacha, which is l'tzarach ochel nefesh, is totally mutter if you plan on doing it for the next day, so you create a new problem. But fundamentally, malacha should be mutter on Yom Tov. Right? Malacha's ochel nefesh is mutter on Yom Tov. So he says, "Mechayev and sheish efshurut shall be at orchem nishar aheter am mekomo." What does Ho'il tell you? That since fundamentally melacha is mutter, the only thing that will make melacha zochel nefesh aser on Yom Tov is if you do it not for Yom Tov. But if it's even plausible that it's for Yom Tov, then it's the heter still exists, right? In other words, it all depends what direction you're coming from, right? If on Yom Tov the status quo is that cooking is mutter, you need to aser it. So if you do it for the next day, it's aser. But if you do it for the next day, but it might be for today, so then it's in this in-between state and remains the status quo, potentially, which is mutter. On Shabbos, the status quo is that all malacha is aser. You need pikuach nefesh to be matir. Ho'el can't create, the possibility of pikuach nefesh can't create a heter when the status quo is aser. So nishar etam ha'mukom, oh, masha enkein, b'shabbos, she pikuach nefesh hevi duchuyo b'lad. Right, pikuach nefesh just pushes aside the iser of azel armin and ho'el. Okay. So that is just ha'ara number one, which I think is important at making. Another mini sugya that we skipped over, and basically the whole sugya comes down to a little passage in the Yerushalmi, is the question of Isas Klavim. Right, so here we are again in Chaf Aleph. So here we're a little bit before this point. I'm not sure how I did in this order, but okay. Right, the Gemara had said as follows, that Moshe Rav Chana Bar Chanila, Isas Klavim, Bizman Sharoan Ochel Mimena Chayeves Bechala. Right, the dough which is for dogs, so when the shepherds also eat it, so Chayeves Bechala, because you have to be mafresh chala because it's considered human food. Arvin ba mishtafin va, you can use it for either an eruv chateros or a sheet of mavos. Mavarchan ala, and you make hamotzi on it. Mizamnin ala, and it's considered chashav enough food that if you have three people, you'll make a zimun. V'nefes b'yom tov, and you can bake it on yom tov. V'adam yotei b'yidei chavasu b'pesach, and you can use it for matzah, assuming you bake it as matzah. The Gemara says v'hamai. Why is that tshuva? Efshalei miflaga b'lisha. Why are you allowed to bake it for the dogs just because the shepherds might eat it? Why don't you just say that you'll split it up while you're kneading it and you only bake some of it? So Gemara said, Chinese is clavim hol efshalei faisim nevela. Since when you have bread for dogs, really you know you might end up eating all of it because you have other food for the dogs. So therefore, all of it could be for the human being, and therefore the food is considered human food. Okay. Now this idea, this concept called Isas Klavim, right? Do four dogs, as the Gemara here tells you, have several implications. Right? The implication of the Gemara is that if something was just Isas Klavim, right, it was only dog food, so then you couldn't cook it on Yom Tov. It wouldn't be considered human food such that you make hamotzi. Maybe you make shahakal, you'd make, I don't know what you would make exactly, right? It's not chashuv enough food to make a zimun on, you can't use it for an eruv, you can't use it for a shituf, you don't have to be mafresh challah, right? That's the implication of the Gemara. Though that's not totally clear. The Mishnahs and the Gemaras in Yerushalmi and Challah discuss whether it's really true, whether we actually exclude all these halachos. But the Gemara's point is that if you have food which is meant only for animals, it's not really human food, and therefore it's not treated fully as human food. But the Gemara never explains what exactly Isas Klavim is. Right? I mean, what is Isas Klavim? Is it just bread that you're cooking for animals? Is it a different type of bread, a different quality? Or is it all about intent? What is it exactly, right? It's bread that's going to dogs. But, right, you could have different things. You could have dog food. You could have, you know, meat, which is starting to go bad, which human beings could eat, but it's not great quality, so you throw it to dogs. You could have perfectly good food that, you know, is just leftovers, right? That you throw the extras from your plate and give it to the dogs, right? Many things could become dog food, right? Which of those dog foods is the Gemara talking about that are not considered full food? So, the Yerushalmi takes this question up in Challah. This is number two. This is the Yerushalmi in Challah. Ezuhi Isas Klavim. What is this thing we call Isas Klavim? So, Reb Shimon ben Lakish Amar, Kol She'irav Ba Mursan. So, he says it has to be bread that you added mursan to. Now, mursan is the chaff, meaning it's very, very coarse bread. So, coming back to our question, right, what is it that transforms something from human food into animal food? According to Reb Shimon ben Lakish, it's not just intent, it's actually the quality of the food. Right? If you had high-quality bread that you just, you know, you are one of these wealth, you know, like these from movies, right? These very wealthy women who feed their dogs like hors d'oeuvres, you know, like have dog hors d'oeuvres and whatever, you know, like all those movies where they have these, like that type of person, right? So if you have high quality food that human beings could eat, it's just that you had your chef make a special dish for your dog, so that would not be Isas Klavim. Isas Klavim has to be something where the quality reflects the fact that it's dog food, the actual object itself, not just your intent. But the Gemara says, but wait a second. Masnisa Amar Bizman Sharoen Ochlin Mimena. Pa'amim She'ena Roem Ochlin Mimena. The problem, right, is that it sounds like this is something that human beings would eat. Now, with Mursan, that's not such a big deal, because coarse bread is not something you wouldn't eat, it's just something you wouldn't normally eat. Right? So that's what the Gemara is pointing out, is that possibility one is the type of thing that human beings could eat, wouldn't normally eat, that's Isas Klavim. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Kol sha'asa ka'avin, v'tani kein asan ka'avin, chayeves, asan limudin, p'tura. It's not about quality, right? Quality would really be dog food. It really depends on the shape, right? And the way you make it. Meaning, there was a certain way that you made animal food and a certain way you made human food. If you make it the right type of loaf, so then it's going to be animal food. The right type of, the wrong type, it will be human food, right? It's just the shape. So this is a second position, right? Rav Shimon ben Lakish says, in order for it to be considered animal food, the quality actually has to reflect the fact that it is animal food and not human food. Rabbi Yochanan says, no, the quality could be the same as human food, but it's not mere intent. You need at least to do something active that shows that you're doing it for animals.
Or
right?
Over substance.
Yes, exactly, right? Meaning, you know, if you braid it like a challah, right? It's not going to your dog. If you just sort of make a blob, so maybe it's going to your dog. Rabbi Ba, B'shem Shmuel. Now, Rabbi Ba in the Yerushalmi is the same as Rabbi Abba in the Bavli, right? The Aleph just drops off, or this is one of those, right, for people who like academic hoc, right, this was one of the central critiques of, not central critiques, this was one of the many critiques that Lieberman had of Neusner's translation of the Yerushalmi, was that he didn't know the rudimentary rules of Yerushalmi Aramaic, which was that alephs often drop off, and therefore he did not realize that Rebbe Ba was a person. And throughout his Yerushalmi, he translated as Rebbe came, right? And the same as Rebbe La, who's Rebbe Ila'a in the Bavli, he translates as Rebbe said no consistently, right? Which makes the entire thing incoherent. So, but Rebbe Ba is just Rebbe Abba. That's all that is. It's really, it's
in the... What does bon Rebbe bon?
What?
What does the word bon mean?
Yeah. Bon. Yeah, it's like, whatever, you know, it's, anyway, whatever, he just says, Rebbe Ba came, it's, you know, whatever, this is what happens when you don't fully understand the ins and outs of Yerushalmi. But anyways, Rebbe Ba, b'shem Shmuel, Rebbe Ami, b'shem Reb Chiya, Ruba, afilo asa keluskin, even if you made it like a beautiful loaf, it doesn't matter. If you intended it for animals, it is. He says, "Klavim v'tanina im eina ro'en ochlam imena." But the Gemara says, "But wait a second. How can you tell me it's a beautiful loaf of bread? We just said that the ro'en, the shepherds, aren't eating it. But why wouldn't they eat a beautiful loaf of bread?" So the Gemara answers, "Tipat der sha'asa mishar rishana shelo yochlam imena." It must be that it was a case where they didn't intend for the human beings to eat, even though they fully could. Right, so you get three distinct shitas of what defines something as animal food. The third shita is the most expansive. All you need to transform something from human food into animal food is intent. Meaning it could be this exact same food, it could be high quality food, it could be something that any normal human being would eat or would want to eat. It doesn't matter. It could be better quality food than human beings would eat, right? It could be this rich woman who has her chef make special hors d'oeuvres that any human being would want, but for her dog. But if it's made for the dog, it is considered dog food, and it has all the halachos that come with it, right? It's not fully human food, and therefore, you can't make it on Yom Tov, you can't use it for Eruv, Shituv, possibly. You have to be mafresh challah, because in the end of the day, it's not human food. It could be human food, but it isn't. What? You don't have to mafresh challah. At the other extreme, you have Reish Lakish, who says no. If something looks like human food, tastes like human food, any normal person would view it as human food, it is human food. The fact that you made it for an animal, that's your problem. Right? If you think that your dog requires high, right, elegant hors d'oeuvres, that's your problem. But in order for something to be animal food and have all the exemptions that come with it, it has to look like, taste like, right? It has to be animal food. It has to be low quality brotus. It doesn't have to be something that is inedible for humans. It doesn't have to be dog food, right? But it has to be something that a human being wouldn't look at it and say, oh, that's what I would have for lunch, l'chatchila. Okay, super coarse bread. If you're hungry, you'll have super coarse bread. If you're on, you know, a high fiber diet and your doctor tells you you can't have any wheat flour, so sure, you'll have that Ezekiel bread, right? Right, which some people really do like. Right, we spent thousands of years trying to perfect the art of making bread, of making fine flour, and then realized that was the worst thing we did for ourselves, and then went straight back to making whole wheat and whole grain breads. And then you have the middle position, Rabbi Yochanan, who says no, you don't need to look at it and say this is disgusting. This is not normal human food. You don't have, and it's not just about intent. You just need to do something, right? Intent is not enough. You need to do something physical that indicates this is not the food I'm having for lunch. You need to make it in a different way, right? You need to braid it differently. You need to shape it differently. Whatever you're going to do, you need to do some sort of action that makes it clear that this is designated for animals. So those are the three positions, right? The Yerushalmi is one of these very nice conceptual Yerushalmis, right? Where the three possible positions sort of just flow from the Yerushalmi, right? Again, it's the three possibilities. It needs to physically be animal food. It's all about intent. Or you just need to do any action that indicates what your intent is. It doesn't have to change the quality. It doesn't have to make it not human food. You just need to actually actualize your intent in some sort of way. And lahalacha, this is still a machlokas. We shouldn't argue on how exactly you should pasken.
Wouldn't logic dictate that it's really dog bread? You know,
which one?
Shepherds.
But which of the three?
Well, it's the guy, the one that takes the sheep to the, basically said it really is bread that's generally not
correct. So that's really, right. I mean, that's the most obvious shita, right? If it looks like dog food, it, you know, then yeah, obviously
why
it is.
You mentioned roim, right? You're mentioning shepherds.
Well, because the point is that if, despite the fact that it's animal food, right, it's the thing you normally give to animals, the shepherds snack on it anyways, right? Because it's not, right? This is not dog food. This is just like low quality bread, and you know, people will snack on it. You know. I mean, look. For example, in Israel, some of the yeshivot hasder are wealthier and some of them are poorer. So I had one friend who went and he spent a few weeks in another yeshiva, not in Gush. What? No, but the yeshiva really doesn't have a lot of money. So for snacks, the yeshiva really leaves out the stale bread, right? Like they have the thing, and as the bread becomes stale, they leave it on. That's what people snack on because it's, you know, sort of crunchy and sort of keeps you full, right? That's not what I eat, right? And, it, you know, that's why the other yeshiva sort of look at Gush, as we're the wealthy yeshiva, because, you know, we eat food, right? So people will snack on sort of coarse, dry bread. It's not inedible, it's just like, you don't normally do it. So Rav Shimon Lakish says, look, under normal circumstances, that's not human food.
Right.
If you are a student in that yeshiva, right? So, and you know that realistically, you know, dry, coarse bread might be a nice filling snack, which is pretty cheap. So, okay, then you're allowed to make it on Yom Tov. That's the point, right? That despite the fact that it is really, it looks like something you wouldn't normally want to eat, if you're going to eat it, you're allowed to cook it, right? That's the point, right? At the other extreme, is the position of Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, right?
We got into the shita whether you're allowed to cook food for animals on Yom Tov.
Right, I mean, this all hangs on the position, right, that you can't. Right, I mean, this is, if you assume that you aren't allowed to cook for animals, so then something which would normally go to animals, but you're going to eat, you're allowed to cook it for yourself.
Which is the machlokes, right?
That was the machlokes that we saw. That was the machlokes Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Yossi Aglili. Right? I mean, that's why we're going a little bit out of order, just because the goy thing was at the beginning, and then the whole rest of the sugya, and then there were these little sugyas in the middle, which we just sort of had to skip to keep coherence. But yeah, meaning this obviously all depends on the shita that it's lochem v'lo l'klavim, which was the machlokes Rabbi Yossi Aglili and Rabbi Kiva. Okay, so the Yerushalmi really presents most of the positions. I just gave you here two other points, though, from the Rashba. So the Rashba in 3 says as follows. He says, Ele'ema kugon di'isle nevela divadei efshel afaisen b'nevela. Right? The Gemara had said that why is it that you're allowed to bake whatever this Isas HaKlavim is because the shepherds will eat it? Why don't you just say whatever the shepherds are going to eat, bake that, whatever the dogs are going to eat, assuming you aren't allowed to bake for dogs, so don't do it. So the Gemara had answered, well, if you have, you know, carcasses around that you could throw to the dogs, so then, basically, you enter the situation as follows, right? You have 3-4 loaves of bread, and you have a bucket full of carcass for the animals. You're going to start by feeding the animals the carcasses. If you run out of the carcass, you give them the bread. But your basic intent is this stale-ish bread will last you, you know, a few days out there being a shepherd. If it turns out you need gifts from the dogs, you'll give to the dog. But basically, your intent is really that it'll be a snack for the shepherd the whole time.
No one needs
it. What? I'm illustrating a bit, but no, not quite that extreme, right? It's where you could. It's you go out there with the bread and the meat, and you. You know,
even though you didn't intend to give the
it's where you
you're going to give the dogs. Let's say you're going to give the dogs from the bread.
It's if
but
you know
you could have given them from the nevela.
Correct.
Whatever you might figure, that's enough.
Right. No, it sounds like really that's enough, right? But the reason is because we know, in the end of the day, if you're hungry, right? I mean, you know, in the back of your mind that if you're really hungry, you'll have all the bread because you have enough food for them. Otherwise, if not, you know, so you'll save the meat for another day and you'll give them the bread now. Right, but you know in your mind that this food could be totally for you.
But you don't have to give them the veil before
you... No, you don't have to give them... Right, that's just for illustrative purposes. But no, right, you're right. I mean, the Gemara sounds like you don't have to do this. Just the fact that you could means all the bread is for you. So then the Gemara says, V'ikal meidak. says Rashba says, Vikla Medak, Mikol Makom, Litsorach Klovim, Vadaita the Klovim, Huova, right? Exactly as Sam said. The simple implication is that it's not the case I illustrated, where he really is intending to give the dogs meat and maybe post facto give them bread. It sounds like the opposite, like Sam said. No, you really are intending to give the dogs bread. It's just that you know that you might not give it to them, but the very fact that you might not give it to them is enough to call it human bread, which is a bit weird, which is what the Rashba is bothered by. But he says, V'yesh lomar, d'yatiru kan, kemosha tiru. What?
Isn't that really ho'el?
Well, that's really the Rashba's question, right? Is the Gemara assumes that this is better than ho'el, right? Because even if you don't hold of ho'el, this is mutter. Right? Or it's, well, or, no. Sorry, the Gemara equates it with ho'el. But the Gemara equates it with ho'el, just said it's a bit better than regular ho'el, but it's basically ho'el. So he says, but why? Meaning, here you're actually intending to do it, to give it to the dog. So he says, V'yesh lomar. Now the Rashba, I assume, it seems like, is working on the assumption that ho'el removes the Isser D'Oraisa, and there's only an Isser D'Rabbanan to cook because of Ho'el. And therefore he says, V'yesh lomar de'tiru kan, kemoshe atiru b'misukenes, be'efshar lo lechol kezayis b'beis ha'shchita. He says, it doesn't matter, because just like under some circumstances, when there's a need, we allow you to do like these quasi-haramas, you know, like we saw, that if you have an animal, which we'll see later on the Gemara, we discussed it when we did Harama, that if you have an animal who's about to die, so you're allowed to shecht it on Yom Tov, and do the Harama of eating one kezias from the animal, right? Because we know otherwise you're going to lose the animal, it's going to die, it's going to be an nevela. So we allow that Harama, because at the end of the day, once you've shechted it and you have a kezias basar, so you justify the ochel nefesh. So the Rashba assumes that, well, that's really what's going on here, that Ho'il, the Ho'il-esque Svara, removes the Isser D'Oraisa, and because, I don't know why exactly you need to bake this bread, but for some reason, there's an assumption that, you know, either you need to bake the bread, or it's just easier to bake the bread once you're baking everything. Under some circumstances, just like we did by Misukenes, where we allow these quasi-haramas, right, these Ho'il-ish haramas, so here we allow it as well, because even though, yes, you're not really planning on giving the bread to, or eating the bread yourself, you're planning on giving them the, sorry, you're planning on giving the bread to the animals as well. Doesn't matter, since you could, so we allow it, right? It's an Isser D'Rabbanan, we waive it under certain circumstances. That's how the Rashba takes it.
So the established haroma in halacha as a valid.
Under certain circumstances. We spent like two or three weeks on haroma. Right, yeah, so, because at the time, Harama comes up four times just in Beitza, so when we got to the one in the second paragraph, we just took all four cases, and we went through different theories of it, partially, well, the Shiram are online if you want to look. We also, you know, did some of Ilana Steinhain's dissertation. Her dissertation was on Harama in Bavli, Rishalmi, Mishnah, Tosefta, and everything. She's your niece?
Uh-huh.
Have you read her dissertation?
No.
She's your niece. She's
my sister's daughter.
Wow, I didn't know that. Naked Shep Nachas. There you go. But yeah, so we spent a lot of time. You can tell her that we enjoyed it very much.
Was that Mindy's daughter?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Rabbi Haines was a scribe.
Right.
It's grand. Okay.
Yeah.
He's Yonah. Right, Yonah. Yeah. Her husband is Yonah. Yeah.
Doesn't he do?
He's a Hill Rabbi. He's Columbia. He's Hill Rabbi at Columbia. Yeah. He was JLIC at NYU, and now he's Hill Rabbi at Columbia. And she's director of education for the North American Education for Hartman now.
Yeah, she was Jewish, right?
She was Lincoln Square.
She was in different places.
Lincoln Square. Most recently, Lincoln Square, right?
Yes, she was like a solemn residence.
Anyways, I'm sure you know better than I do, but you can tell we enjoyed it. And have you read? You said you haven't read it.
No.
Okay, it's good. It's good. I think Melech gave. Well, no, it's. I think I just googled it and got it online. Columbia has it. Anyways, the Ramban in 4 says as follows. Right, this is the Rashba citing the Ramban has a slightly different perspective, and he says Ramban. Nun reish, so natre rachmana, right? right, when you see Nun Reish or Nun Reish Vav, it's Natre Rachmana, right, meaning that make, right, God protect him, right, and Nun Reish Vav is, right, Neiru is Natre Rachmana Uparke, right, may God protect him and redeem him. So Natre Rachmana. Kazav, Da Abaye, Mishum Din Nola Din Ninhu, Kabay Mine Mi De Rav Yosef, Ukabon Tamarim Shachon Beyomtov. Vahachi Kamar, right, this is how it goes. This is what he was asking. Bishlam la Rabbi Kiva, the Amar Nefesh Behema Bimashma. If you understand like Rabbi Kiva, that Nefesh Behema, right, then that cooking for an animal is included in Ochel Nefesh. So Kevan Shatmarim Muchanim. You know what, I'm going to leave the Ramban for now because really it comes to the stuff on the next stuff. It straddles the sugya, so I'm gonna leave it, and we'll come back to this Ramban, I hope. Yeah, we'll come back to it. Okay, so that's the Isas Klavim. The last sugya of this sugya, right? The last issue in this sugya, which is what we'll deal with now till the end, or series of sugyas, are the Muktzeh issues that arose here. So now, if we turn to Amud Bet, right? So the Gemara says as follows. This is the two dots in Chaf Aleph Amud Beis. Amar Le Abaye Rav Yosef. Ule Rav Yosef Aglili D'Amar Lochem V'Lul Klavim. According to Rav Yosef Aglili, that Lochem excludes animals. Right? Lochem excludes animals. So I have a bigger problem than just not cooking for animals. Hani Sufsele L'Chiyusav. Right, so as Rashi says, Garin and Tamarin. Right, these pits from dates. How are you even allowed to throw pits to dogs on Yom Tov? Because at the end of the day, it's Mukta, and how can you even violate Mukta for dogs on Yom Tov? So Amar Lei, Ho'ul V'chazu L'Hasaka. Since the pits of dates have a purpose on Yom Tov, right? They're not worthless if you don't give them to dogs. They have a purpose. You could use them in a fire. So the Gemara says, that's fine. Tenech biabeshta. That's great if the seeds that you're talking about are dry. Biratifta ma'ikamim. Or what if they're wet? You can't burn them. Samarlu, yes you can. Chazal has a gadol. If you have a big fire, so you can throw in anything. So the Gemara says, tenech biyomtov. So that's fine. So on Yom Tov, maybe I have a purpose for the pits of my fruit. So I'm allowed to throw it to the dogs so they're not muksa. But b'shabbos ma'ikamim. Or how am I allowed to feed my dogs on Shabbos with these, you know, bones and pits and things like that? They're mukta. So the Gemara says, "Metaltlu agav rifta." I'm going to carry them on a bread, on bread. Meaning, I'm not going to pick them up myself. I'm going to let them fall onto a slice of bread, and I'm going to carry them with a slice of bread and throw it to the dog. Kiddush Shmuel, because that's Shmuel's position. The Amar Shmuel, Osa Adam called Tarcho Bipas. That if you need to avoid problems of mukta, because you have something which is muksa, which you need to move, so instead of moving it by itself, put it on a loaf of bread and carry the bread. Upligat Reshub ben Levi, and this is against the position of Reshub ben Levi. Damer Reshub ben Levi mizamnin es anachri b'Shabbos, ve'ein mizamnin es anachri b'Yom Tov. Gzeira shem yarbe b'Shvilo. Right, you're allowed to invite a guy on Shabbos, but not on Yom Tov, because you might cook for him. Rav Acha bar Yaakov or Rav Afilu b'Shabbos nami lo mishum shiurei kosos. Rav Acha said you aren't even allowed to invite a guy on Shabbos, not because of a cooking problem, because of a mukta problem. Because what shiurei kosos? The leftover wine in his cup is going to be stamienum, right? Because in their time, you had two drinks in the world. You had water and you had wine, right? So if someone came over, you were giving them wine. Right, you didn't just give them water. Right, water was.
What did you say? Yai nesach.
It's not yai nesach. Unless they do a libation, right?
Well, maybe he made a bracha on it.
And maybe he did, but if he didn't, it would. Best case scenario, it's tam yinam.
Right.
Okay. Right. Okay. So, right. I mean, I've mentioned this before, right? If you look at the records of the Mayflower, right? Perfect today, Thanksgiving. Yeah, I forgot. But you look at the records of the Mayflower, one of the reasons they ended up where they did and didn't go farther was because they ran out of beer. right? And they said, the sailors could drink water, but the women and children, without beer, what are they going to do? Right? Because water was hard. Water was, right, was contaminated. Right. Beer, alcohol, would kill the bacteria, the germs, so it was much better to drink alcohol. So everyone drank alcohol, right? Water was like a novelty. So if someone came to your house, you were giving them alcohol. You were giving them, in the time of the Gemara, mostly wine. So if a guy came over, you gave them wine. And it was not mavushal, right? It's not like now where we use flash pasteurization and call everything mavushal. Because our wines, which are mavushal, are not cooked. And in the time of the Gemara, when you had wine, which was mavushal, you cooked it, right? For the record, that makes the wine lower quality, right? You don't really want to do that, so most people didn't do it. Our wine, we have this cool thing called flash pasteurization, where we electrocute it for about a second, and it boils for a second. It kills all the germs, right? That's how we get rid of the bacteria. And we, and Rosh Hashanah and Paschal, and that counts as bishul, right? But we don't actually cook it. So for us, it's very easy to create mevushal wine, right? We just flash pasteurize it. In the time of the Gemara, if the guy came to your house, you were giving him non-mevushal wine, and guess what that did, right? We would have a heart attack, right? We keep our, you know, fleishik on this side and our dairy on that side, and treif doesn't enter the house. Here, we invited the guy in, we gave him wine, knowing that the second he touches the wine, you need to, right? That cup is filled with non-kosher food, right? And you need to do something about that. You need to clean it out. If it's cheres, right, you may need to do more than cleaning it, right? You gotta really get that wine out. You do need some sort of quasi-koshering process, right? As we'll see, that it might sort of be considered koshering. So according to Rabbi Achbar Yaakov, you're not allowed to invite a guy on Shabbos because you're going to give him a cup of wine, and then the cup is going to become mukta because it's going to be filled with damyenam. So the Gemara says, wait a second. Ihachi, tidon nami. So then we shouldn't be allowed to drink either, because when we drink, it's true, it doesn't become stam yenam, but it becomes icky. It becomes icky, right? Our cups, after we finish using them, are disgusting, right? There's that residue on the bottom, which means that at least until after Shabbos, until we get a chance to give it a good clean, right? Because remember, we can clean it with cold water, but even if we use cold water, which we have accessible, we have soap, so you can pour good, high-powered soap, and then you can get your, you know, Somet Shabbos, you know, Shabbos sponge, and you can mostly get things out of it, and it can be usable by the next meal, right? They were talking, you know, about, I don't know, clay cups, right, which were somewhat porous, and the way you cleaned your dishes was you put them in a big pot and boiled them, right? And you don't exactly have water as easily accessible, right? You gotta, you know, who knows? You need to go down to the river, you need to go down to the well, whatever you're doing, right? You weren't cleaning your dishes on Shabbos. I've mentioned this before, that when I was learning Shabbos with Rai Willig, this would come up every so often, because Rai Willig, you know, he's an amazing posek, so he loves understanding mitzvahs and trying to figure out what exactly was the Gemara imagining. But sometimes it's hard to figure it out, because, like, we are so far removed from the world of the Gemara that, like, you have to, like, you know, what we think of backwards is, like, you know, 1,500 years past what the Gemara is even thinking. We have to, like, go back, like, five stages. We're, like, you know, we think, like, our dishes aren't clean when we've cleaned it the way I just said, right? We don't even imagine, like, we don't have water to clean it. You don't have soap. You don't have anything.
They use sand.
What?
They use sand.
Right. What I did a few times, I would call my mother, because my mother spent 3 years in the Peace Corps in Botswana, right, back in the 70s, right? And Botswana in the 70s, I'm not sure exactly what it's like now, Botswana in the 70s looked not so much more advanced than, you know, 5th century, you know, Babylonia, whatever, 5th century Babel. Like, you know, my mother said, you got water from the well, you know, and that was when you realize, when you don't have water, you clean things very, very differently. Right, like certain things you just didn't clean, like potatoes. You don't clean them before you cook. Before you cook them, if you don't have water, they don't need to be cleaned. You just throw them in the fire.
Or use uric acid.
My mother didn't do that one, right? She said, like, potatoes, you just put straight in the fire. But dishes, you know, you clean. You boil up a just like your bath, right? Your bath was you boiled up the water and then you poured it into a bathtub and hoped that by the time you'd filled up it, you know, filled up your bathtub with enough pots of boiling water, it was still at least lukewarm, right? And you didn't really have electricity, right? So in the time of the Gemara, if your cup got dirty, it was dirty till after Shabbos, until the next time you had the energy to get enough water to clean all your dishes. So the Gemara says, I don't care about just shiurei kosher, say iser, it is ihachi didan nami. Ours also are filthy, they're disgusting, they're going to be mukta at the end of Shabbos. So the Gemara says, no, didan chazir l'tar negolin. Whatever garbage is left at the bottom of our plates, just get your chickens, right? They can eat it. You're not going to eat that stuff, but they will. So Gemara says, okay, did hu nami chazal tarnagolan? If that's your solution, the non-Jews, the dregs at the bottom of the wine, non-Jews cup could also go to the chickens. They're not muzhar on stam yinam.
Drunk chickens.
What? Drunk. Yeah, why not? Gemara says, no, did hu, is there a hanan in hu? That's the problem, is that stam yinam is an iser hanah. You can't give it to your chickens. And that's the difference. So the Gemara says, I don't get it. Why can't you move the cup? Because the cup is not mukta. Milo amar Rava metaltlin kinuna agav kitme. Aren't you allowed to move the, I don't know what the English is for this, the vessel that you put the coals in, whatever it is, the fire, I don't know what it's called, because of the kitme, because of the dirt, the ashes that are in it, that are usable, right? Because you would use ashes for things, to cover blood and the like. Even though there are also, you know, wood shards on it. So the Gemara says, because it's Yisrei Hanah, and here it's not. And then the Gemara brings up another thing. It should be mutter to move it, because there's a halacha called Graf Shel Re'i. Now what's Graf Shel Re'i? So literally, it is a Graf Shel Re'i is the vessel which you went to the bathroom in, right? Now, even though normally things which are disgusting, such that you don't want to touch them, are mukta, Graf Shel Re'i is so disgusting that it removes the mukta, which is what we'll discuss at the end, right? So why isn't this cup with the Isurei Hana'a dregs of wine at the bottom? So that's, most of the Rishonim understand it as Kavod Abriya, right? It's a function of Kavod Abriya, though we'll see exactly how far that goes, right? That's the end of this. Yeah, it's most of the end of the Makaros here. So why isn't the cup like that? So Amar Lei, you're right, it would be Vichios and Graf Shel Re'i Lechatchila, but you're not allowed to Lechatchila make something into a Graf Shel Re'i, right? If it is a Graf Shel Re'i, right? So then that's fine, but you can't invite a guy such that the cup will then become a Graf Shel Re'i, so then you're then allowed to move it. Okay, so...
What if I want to make a racist comment and say it's not a problem because a guy would never leave anything left in the cup?
Yes, if we wanted to make covers like that, that's what we would do. So
your parents must be Russian or Polish.
Both. So one of each. There you go. Okay, so the
why is that? Is a guy. Sheker is a detective is my valor is a guy. It's a Yiddish nursery rhyme.
So
you're a Russian way that this
did. What?
You're inviting the guy. You're not taking the Russian way.
But so.
He makes the graph.
Correct, but you're initiating the situation in which the graph will be made. Right, that's the...
You could say that, going to the bathroom, people shouldn't eat on Shabbos because you're initiating the situation.
Right, but so the question is, when is it, you know, when is it considered lechatchila and when is it not? Now, that sugya is actually a later sugya. Here it just comes up as a one-liner. The main sugya is on Lamed Vav.
Well, why couldn't you just leave the cup where it is after Shabbos?
Because we don't want you to, you know, make the situation of a Graf Shel Re'i. That's right. What the Gemara is assuming. We don't want to make you.
But assuming it's not Graf Shel Re'i.
Right. So these are all the issues So that's all the issues that we have to deal with. So this unit in the Gemara, these last unit in the Gemara, basically, right, has moved from the Doraisa. We've pivoted from the Doraisa. Now we've moved into the Muktzah realm. Right. We've said, in addition to all the problems that we've talked about, cooking for non-Jews, cooking for animals, and the like. Right, for klav and for nachrim, there's another problem, which is these situations can create mukta problems. Right, whenever you eat, and whenever you have somebody eating, there's mukta problems. So we just need to go through these. There's basically three mukta problems that we need to deal with. One is how is the mukta question related to the lechem v'lo leklavim, lechem v'lo nakram discussion? And is it, are they actually related, or they're just two separate problems that we contend with? The second problem is this issue of the metaltlin agav, right, where we carry things on bread, and that somehow solves the problem magically of mukta. And the bigger one, the biggest one, is the graf shalrei, right? How exactly to define this amorphous, this hard to understand category? So let's just start with the first question. That's the Ramban, right? The Ramban in four. So the Gemara here had said, right, for some bizarre reason, that Rabbi Yossi Aglili's position, namely lachem lo leklavim, that midaraisa, you're not allowed to cook for animals, somehow affects mukta and makes it that you're not allowed to throw food to animals. And the Ramban asked the obvious question, which is, how did we get from one to two? Right? Meaning, Rabbi Yossi Aglili says you're not allowed to cook for animals on Yom Tov. How does that tell you that you're not allowed to throw mukta to him? Mukta means something has no purpose. But feeding your animal is a purpose. Why does the fact that I'm not allowed to cook for my animal mean that feeding my animal is considered purposeless such that it's mukta, right? Those two things don't actually go together. It would have been coherent to say, Rabbi Yossi Aglili says you're not allowed to cook for your animal on Yom Tov, but you do have to feed your animal, and therefore any food for your animal is not mukta, because it has a purpose, namely feeding your animal. Right? What does one have to do with the other? So that's what the Ramban says in 4. He says, Ramban niru kasa, natri rachmana kasa. The abayim yishum dun no ladin ninhu, kabayim yinemid rav Yosef, who kamon tamarim sha'achlam the Yom Tov. Vahachi gamar, this is the question. He says, bishlam le Rabbi Kiva, the Amar Nefesh Behema B'Mashma Kevan Shatmarim Muchanim L'Maychal Adam Erev Yom Tov Muchan L'Adam Muchan L'Klavim Shair Muchanim Heim L'Tzorech Ochol Nefesh V'Tzorech Nefesh Behema Tzorech Ochol Nefesh. He says, Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Yossi Aglili aren't just arguing about whether you're allowed to cook for animals or not. What are they really arguing about? They're arguing about when the Torah tells you that Ochel Nefesh, meaning that Yom Tov, you're allowed to prepare, that we take seriously the needs of certain groups of creatures, right? Who are those beings that we care about? Rabbi Kiva says, people. Other way around. Rabbi Yossi Aglili says, people, not animals. Rabbi Kiva says, no, even animals. But if that's what they're saying, they're not just saying, are you allowed to cook for animals or not? The question is, what types of living beings does the Torah take seriously on Yom Tov? So according to Rabbi Kiva, it's animals as well. And therefore, that has implications on the level of Doraisa, that you're allowed to cook for them. It has implications on the level of Derabanan, that food that's edible for animals is Mimela, not Mukta. And therefore, if you have your, right, what's the case? The dates. Right? So what's the problem here? You have dates. The dates are human food. The question now is the tamarim. It is the garinin, the pits of it. So what potential muksa is there? No lud. Meaning it's a new thing that didn't exist before. It's a somewhat useless thing. But he says, if you're a Bikiva and you think that the Torah takes seriously all, right, animals and human beings, that means that the whole date was miuad for nifashot on Yom Tov. The date for human beings, and the pit for animals. And therefore, it's not muksa, because the whole thing could be justified as having a purpose for a nefesh. The part that would go to people would go to people. The part that would go to animals would go to animals. Elder Biosi Haglili, Damar Ein B'Mashma Nefesh Behema. But according to Biosi Haglili, that the word nefesh on Yom Tov doesn't mean animals. So Haroy Lol Adam Muchan. Then, in order for something to be considered Muchan, to be considered not Muksa, to be considered purposeful on Yom Tov, it needs to be for a human being. V'she'ein aroy el leklavim. But if it's only for animals, einu bechlal hachana. Then it's not considered prepared. Shezem muchan ochel nefesh v'zein ochel nefesh. Because the tamarim are for nefashot. And the pits are for animals, but animals aren't nefashot. V'heichi mitaltalina. So how can you move it? Uparkinan, and that's why the Gemara had answered, Hol v'chazu lahasaka. No, the pits have a human purpose, namely for a fire. Shekeman shehochnu l'tzarech adam muchanan hein af lahasaka, shav hein hu tzarech ochel nefesh. And once they're ochel nefesh, so then memela you can throw them to the dogs, because the need of the dogs is enough that if something's not muksa, you can give it to them. But since the Torah doesn't fundamentally recognize them as a nefesh for a yom tov, the fact that it's animal food doesn't remove the status of muksa. But if there's any human factor, it'll lose muksa. Once it's not muksa, you can feed the animals. And that's the connection between the d'oraisa and the d'rabbanan. Right? Is how do we make something defined as necessary? According to Rabbi Kiva, if it's necessary for an animal, it's already necessary, and therefore it's not muksa. According to Rabbi Kiva, it needs to have a human... Sorry, according to Rabbi Yosi Aglili, if it's for an animal, that's not recognized. It needs to have a human need. Once it has a human need, then mimela, you're allowed to use it even so for animals.
So that's a hoel?
What?
Is that a hoel?
No, it's not a hoel.
It's not a
hoel? No, it's simply... Right, because muksa isn't about hoel. Muksa is this or is it not necessary? Right? Or necessary is the wrong word. Is it or is it not usable? Right? Or purposeful. That's the word I'm looking for. Purposeful, right? Muksa isn't about ho'il. It's not a ho'il. It's, since it's chazi la'asaka, it is objectively purposeful. Once it's objectively purposeful, it's purposeful, it's not muksa. Once it's not muksa, you can do whatever you want with it. Right?
Why purposeful and not usable?
Right, because, meaning it's usable for animals, right? But the point is it has to be purposeful, right? It needs to be that a purpose that's recognized halakhically. Right, but once it is purposeful, you can do whatever you want, right? Or potentially purposeful, or whatever, or usable for a recognized purpose, or a, in this case, a ochel nefesh purpose. However we want to play with the words.
All right, so there are purposes that are not ochel nefesh, that are recognized halakhically.
Correct. Okay. Right. And that's what strikes me as weird about the Ramban, is I don't...
Yeah, because most of the examples that aren't ochel nefesh, they're dochek to find some way that they're
ochel nefesh.
Yeah, that it is.
They're ochel nefesh, exactly.
Yeah, like this, it's hasaka, is, you know.
Is a fire, and a fire is ochel nefesh, exactly.
It's carrying, it's, you know, you carry to a
meal, and therefore,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's the question one, right? Which, what's the connection between the daraisa and the Dirabbanan of Muksa? Okay, I think we're going to have to stop there. We'll do the next two issues next week, which is the Metalflin Agav and then the Graf Shalrei. Now, Graf Shalrei is really a big sugya. I really just put very sort of basic Makaros just to give an overview, and hopefully when we one day get to, you know, Lamed Vav, we will go into the depths of the sugya. But here it just comes up as a parenthetical sugya.